If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
We tend to harvest at least 2 weeks in advance compared to like 20 years ago, for example.
To farm 128 acres of wine grapes here, we need about 30 people. It's a labor-intensive industry.
No doubt about it. The easy part in the wine business is actually making the wines. However, selling it and branding it, that's a completely different story.
We've done more single vineyard calves, and it's really been the vineyard telling us where to go more than us saying, oh, we want to do single vineyard calves.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 419. This week we feature Luke Goldschmidt, cellar hand. Years ago, podcast number 305 featured Nick Goldschmidt of Goldschmidt Vineyards in Sonoma. This week, almost 2 years to the date, we caught up with his son, Luke Goldschmidt, who is a cellar hand working his way through the industry. In fact, as a message to our listeners who are winemakers, Luke is looking for an enologist job. If you're interested, Luke's email address appears on our website. Meanwhile, we had a great chat talking about his time working in cellars all over the world. Wine, after all, is family. It's also travel as well. You can hear Luke on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term La Bota. This is an interview I've been looking forward to doing, although I look forward to all my interviews. But I'm on the phone with Luke Goldschmidt, and Luke is son of Nick Goldschmidt from Goldschmidt Vineyards. Luke, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Ray?
I'm good. It's really good to talk to you. Geez, when we first got on the phone, I half expected an accent, but you've been raised on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, exactly. It is a little bit different from my dad. Definitely have had a lot of influence from him, but, you know, also growing up in a different area, in a different wine country, get lots of different influences.
Your dad's a great guy. Great sense of humor, great attitude towards life, and he makes some pretty darn good wine.
Yeah, he's definitely got it's nice to have him, you know, other than just being a father, but also a mentor. You know, I'm coming with him with all kinds of different kind of questions and stuff and getting to see he really is a pro. So seeing his winemaking styles and growing up around them, I've definitely been greatly influenced by that. But it's also kind of pushed me to look for new things as well, because I've become so familiar with his style.
And, you know, right now you're in between jobs is what we were saying before we got on the interview. You work harvest. You've done all kinds of things in the wine industry. You'd mentioned you were working for somebody recently, just coming out of harvest.
Yeah, so I've finished my degree in enology at Fresno almost 4 years ago now. And immediately I kind of jumped into the traveling harvest kind of path where you jump between hemispheres. So I just completed my 7th harvest back-to-back, which is quite a lot. 7 harvests in 3.5 years.
Wow.
And I was with Aperture Cellars in Healdsburg, which was an awesome place. It's a new place. Jesse Katz is the winemaker, and I had met him a couple years prior. But he comes from the exact same program as me, so it was really cool, you know, seeing him being 10 or so years older than me, seeing where he is in this industry.
Interesting. Just going back and forth, have you been traveling with your dad recently, or are you living two completely separate worlds of wine?
You know, it is, I would say, separate worlds, but we overlap so often. So when I've been working in other countries, when I've been working in South America in particular, both in Argentina and in Chile, I've done harvests, and both times while I was down there, he'd actually come and visit me for say a week. He's down there for a couple of weeks, and maybe for a weekend he picks me up and we'll go check out some of the vineyards that he's working with, and I'll go and sit with him while he's doing blending in these other countries. And I mean, I do this as well here in California, but to get that extra exposure in one of those South American countries is really beneficial for me, and to also see my dad like working in those environments is much different than seeing him work in the environments here in California.
Yeah, man, when it comes to an education, I mean, you really can't. Obviously, you have
schooling, but this is real world schooling with a real world guy who travels the entire globe on a regular basis. That's nuts.
Yeah, to see how an example of that really functions. You know, I've grown up around a couple different foreign winemakers, just because, I mean, my dad's foreign, so he ends up making friends with all the Aussies and South Africans and things like that. But then I get to see, you know, what kind of position some of these other international winemakers are in, and how are they navigating moving around? Because I really do enjoy the travel part of the winemaking. You know, it's not sustainable in the future to be working in that kind of way. I'd like a more permanent job. So I just kind of meant I'd like to see those different winemakers showing that example of how they've made it work.
Well, we're going to have your email address at the end of this. So if there's any winemakers listening, and we do have a lot of winemakers who follow us, here's your little advertisement right now. Luke is looking for a gig.
Yeah, if anyone needs a helping hand, I've got lots of work in the cellar and the vineyards and elsewhere, but looking for a permanent role at this point.
Sure. You know, but again, to have that education, being around Nick and to see that world he lives in.
No.
And he does live in the world. He doesn't live in one place for any period of time. He is a classic globe. I don't know of anybody like him, actually.
Yeah. I don't know. He talks of, like, maybe there's two other people that do what he does, but I don't even remember their names. They're just kind of hidden guys traveling around. But, yeah, I don't know. It's been much different this year because the travel's been so restricted that he's actually had to be home probably more than he has ever been in my memory. So it's been quite interesting. And you know, my parents have had to adapt to change their business a little bit to, you know, just like everyone else has.
Sure.
But has worked out all right. And he's just started to travel a little bit again. I think he's gone down to South America one time this year, unlike usually three times or so.
It's amazing. What a life. I mean, it's a gypsy life, but as a winemaker, as dedicated as he is, it's something. But we're talking about your dad, and we're supposed to be talking about you. So let's do that.
Yeah.
You grew up in this atmosphere. I mean, are you one of those guys? The wine was in your veins as a kid? Or how did that work out for you?
Yeah, my transition was it was very natural, I think. You know, my dad in particular did not influence me to be a winemaker at all. In fact, I can remember him telling my siblings and I to not go into wine. But it was strange. I mean, as I was growing up, you know, it'd be the weekend and he'd offer me, you know, a little bit of pay to go work on a bottling line or go dig a tank out or whatever. So in high school, I start doing like little odd jobs in wineries because I could use just a little bit of money for the weekends or whatnot. And I knew I wanted to travel. So end of high school came around and I had to like kind of make a decision on what I wanted to focus on in college. And I knew I wanted to travel, and I saw wine as a vehicle for that possibility pretty early on. And it was also something that I liked. I was really good at, I'm really good at sciences, really good in chemistry. It was kind of like a natural direction to go. I didn't tell my dad I wanted to do it. I told my mom. And then applied to Fresno State and Davis and Cal Poly and ended up going to Fresno. And from there, I definitely still had the focus on to travel, which is what I did immediately after graduating. So once I graduated, I harvest hopped is what people call it. And I worked in California and then to Chile in the Southern Hemisphere. I went north to Louis Latour in Burgundy, France.
Wow.
And then I went south. Some of the places I got to work were really incredible. Opus One was where I got to work in California after graduating. It was a good example of, you know, of a way to make wine, like very high, like perfectionist, very perfectionist.
Sure.
But I also got to work in Penfolds Grange in South Australia. And then I moved on to Campo Viejo in Spain. And then finally to Catena Zapata in Argentina before I came back to California this year.
Wow. That's really impressive. The big thing there is when you're looking for a gig to have that on your resume, that's a big deal.
Yeah. It was a lot of work. You know, I would get a job basically, and in the first 3 weeks of my job, I would be doing harvest, and I would also, after work, have to go home, and I'd get on the computer and immediately be looking for a new job in the next hemisphere because that transition happened so quickly. So I generally only worked for say, for 3 to 5 months. And then I get like maybe a month or 2 months off and have to switch countries. So I actually didn't, I thought it was funny, I never saw the season of spring for like 3 years.
That's crazy. Well, again, it's interesting to have this experience and then have it culminate in a gig. Now, you had mentioned to me you were looking to, at this point, be an enologist, which is the more scientific side of winemaking. But is it the goal eventually to be a winemaker, or you just kind of want to take it step by step and see how it goes?
Yeah, I think it's got to be a little bit of both. I've been realizing recently that I've been trying to set a new goal for myself. So post-university, my goal was to do that, the traveling harvest gig, and I've done that for three and a half years, and now I feel like I haven't set my next goal for, say, a five-year span. I have one for 10 years, but so the end goal is I would like to be a winemaker myself. I would like to make my own brand. I did make a little bit of wine myself this year.
Nice.
During harvest, it was, you know, extra work, but that's all right. But for now, I think I could get the most beneficial experience working with someone else, a company that is, looking for someone that can, I want to be able to contribute to a company as well as learn from it. So to find a position that they're willing to teach me a little bit, but I also have so much to give both in the vineyards and in the winery.
Sure, I'll bet. A little curious, though, about you were talking about you didn't tell your dad up front. What did he say to you when he found out that this is what you're going to do?
Yeah, he questioned it a little bit. Like, are you really sure you want to do this? This isn't, like, the way, like, if you're trying to make money, this isn't necessarily what it is. But I think I fell for all the reasons to make wine before it was actually wine. Like, you know, I really love the idea of the travel. I love the idea of, you know, making something that is, you know, so artistic and involved with the earth, but it's also quite scientific. I love, as part of that travel aspect, I love going to other countries and being able to sit down at a table and anywhere that they make wine, it's like in the blood that you sit at the table and you share your food, and you're really, really grateful, really humble, really inclusive to people as well. And those are kind of the reasons I liked wine first. And then I was like, okay, wine is just the, you know, that string that connects all these different countries to the same kind of culture. That's really beautiful, really, something that I fell for immediately.
Yeah, I'll bet. I like your use of the word inclusive, because it is true. Wine is inclusive. It doesn't see ethnic money, unless you're buying expensive bottles. It doesn't matter who you are. You love it. That's it.
Yeah, there's a lot of different tiers of it. Obviously, there's wines that are super luxury and become unattainable to others. But, you know, if you go in many parts of Italy, I studied in Italy for a little while, and all the wineries there, I mean, most of them are mom and pop stuff and you know,
sure,
much maybe lower grade, but so much more accessible to people. And the culture there of it is just so much larger, because everyone has the access to, you know, these wines. Everyone's got a friend that makes wine in their garage or whatever.
It's an amazing country. Clearly, you've been bitten by the bug and you have the passion. So this is a very broad question, and it can conclude any alcohol. What do you like to drink? What's your favorite?
Oh, man. I'm pretty seasonal, actually. So I guess harvest season, I'm pretty much just drinking beer.
Yep.
Can't handle more wine. But, I mean, for example, right now I'm up in Lake Tahoe, so it's pretty cold, and I'm a big fan of hot toddies. So a bit of whiskey, lemon, and agave in hot water.
Nice.
But I also love Bloody Marys in the morning. Sparkling is something that I've been kind of getting into a little bit more. I didn't really drink too much sparkling wine for a long time, but had a friend who was really passionate about sparkling wine, actually. And he introduced me to all these different kinds of stuff and kind of changed my mind about it. So actually, sparkling wine is something that has popped up recently for myself that I'm a bit more into.
Have you had any experience working with sparkling at all?
You know what? No, I haven't. I've done no sparkling wine. And most of those wineries that I worked are really well known for their red wines.
Sure.
So haven't actually gotten too much sparkling wine. Have done an orange wine and a little bit of white wine, but never sparkling.
It's interesting because so many more people are drinking sparkling. I think men in particular had this thing. It's either a celebration wine or not. And more people are saying, this is really good. This is fun stuff to drink.
Yeah, honestly. And I think that was the big thing that my friend kind of showed me. It was like, hey, you know what? You can actually drink a sparkling wine with your meal. And that was like, usually I associate my food with a red wine or
sure. A
different kind, maybe white wine, but not really associating a meal with sparkling wine too much. And he kind of like changed that a little bit for me. I think it's got a different attitude. I agree. I think that it's growing.
Yeah, it's getting there, and I hope it continues to get there. With that in mind, that you've been in these different places and in the United States, are there any areas in the country that you're looking at going, hey, they're making some good stuff? I mean, you have, of course, Oregon, Washington, but I mean, here in Wisconsin, they're making wine. They're making wine in Virginia, even Florida, Texas is, we have a podcast coming up, which would have aired by now, about Texas. Have you had a chance to look into other parts of the country?
Only little bits here and there because I've been traveling so internationally. To be honest, my national travel's pretty poor. I've been to as many U.S. states as I have European countries. But I have tasted a couple wines, like Tempranillo from Texas is something that is quite unusual. But
sure,
their Tempranillo and their Grenache, I've had a few that have like popped out to me as a pretty unusual part of the U.S. But places that I often think about are a bit more, you know, inhabited. Like, I often think about the Anderson Valley in California. I'm from Healdsburg, so it's right in between the Dry Creek, Alexander Valley, and the Russian River Valley, which are, you know, super, you know, high-end for different wines themselves. All three of those valleys make different excellent wines, but Anderson Valley is something that's a little bit further north, and again, I think they make amazing sparkling,
yeah.
As well as some cool Chardonnay and Pinots. I think that is a style that I associate with Burgundy a little bit more, almost, and I really am interested in it and have never gotten to work there.
It's I've been up there. Anderson Valley is a wonderful place. In fact, we just did an interview with somebody from Mendocino recently, but getting back on track here, as a guy who has spent time in the cellar, do you get to spend much time in the vineyard itself? Are you actually doing anything in terms of actual harvesting yourself, or is that just not your area?
It kind of depends on the job, actually. So in the past, I used to be a vit tech for Redwood Empire Vineyard Management. So most of my work there was before the harvest. It was over summer, and I would be doing things like water potential in the vines, seeing what kind of growth stages the vines are at. Are they, is it set? Is it flowering? You know, what stage of aeration are we through? But I've also, that's here in California. When I was in France, the harvest was really fast. So at the end, I ended up doing 7 weeks of pruning for them in Burgundy, which was super beneficial as well. Like learning about the sap flow and, you know, where you are going to get the most vigor coming out of your vine when you're pruning it. And even this year, surveying some vineyards, taking samples, checking for replants, things like that. I have spent a fair amount of time in the vineyards, but generally not in the middle of harvest season. During harvest season, I'm pretty much in the winery. I'm not picking the grapes, but before and after, much more so.
Sure. Yeah, well, that makes sense. So between the cellar and the vineyard, probably more the cellar, any crazy experience? I'm sure you've had a few that you can talk about.
Yeah, I can think of a couple, like, I guess fermentations that, you know, went awry. So I went to Chile after being at Opus in California, and I worked at a place called Viña Razzurris, which makes Chadwick and Seña, which are really top Chilean wines. But it was a large cellar, and it was the first time I'm working in another country, and I'm in charge of a team, and I'm speaking a second language. I do speak pretty good Spanish, but this was very early on, so my Spanish was still quite rusty at the time. But we do 12-hour days, and the other interns, we lived in a house together, so there are 8 of us in the house.
Mm.
So 4 of us are always in the winery, and 4 of us are always at home. We just switched spots for a couple months. And so my counterpart is... She's basically working on the cellar floor, and I go to switch shifts with her. And when I meet her, we're standing in front of a massive tank, maybe maybe 40,000 gallons, is fairly sized, and it is just spilling over tons and tons and tons of fruit. It's been overfilled because I guess capacity was short. I don't know, something in the middle of the night went wrong. And this tank, we ended up having to take out huge amounts of wine from it and leaving it in bins. And Chile was, it wasn't super organized at the time. You know, we're scrambling to find equipment to like use, even pumps. I mean, this is a field with 200 tanks in it. And we ended up having to leave a good volume of wine out in bins for like days. And every day that we're doing a pump over on this tank, myself or my counterpart, we're trying to inch a little bit more wine back into the tank and topping it up every single day. And every single day it's going over and we're cleaning it. It was a bit of a mess. lasted about 5 days.
Oh my gosh. That must have been, that'd be hard to go to sleep after that.
Yeah, it was not great. It wasn't great. But it was, you know, it was early on in my experience. I was definitely still learning. What I might do about it now might be different than what I did about it then. I'm not sure.
Well, it makes a big difference, obviously, the experience you have. You know, you look down the road. I've never really asked anybody this question, and I don't know how often you deal with consumers, but I'm sure you talk to friends. They know you're in the wine business. But is there a question you ever get asked that you don't like being asked about wine?
No, sometimes there's just kind of critiques about wine that I just don't really understand, really. I can't think of something in particular that I've heard a few times that I've been like, come on, I don't want to hear that. I guess one pet peeve is when people pick up their glass, you know, by the bowl and they don't hold it by the stem or the foot. That's a silly thing that, you know, I've got a couple friends that I point that out to and they don't fix it. But outside of that, I can remember, you know, pouring wine for my family one time in a Safeway, just having a couple of our wines and pouring them to the customers and such. And someone had come up and, you know, tried our, I think I was probably pouring like four different wines, four different price levels, poured all these wines. And she's like, the first one didn't like anything. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And then she proceeded to, you know, stare at the wall of wine in the supermarket for like 15 more minutes, like right in front of me, like 15 minutes. And I'm like, you sure you won't want to just try this wine again? Like, you really have no idea what you want. And like this wine I'm pouring is like, you know, top wine for its price point, like what it was. It's a great deal or whatever it was. And just straight up didn't like any of them. And, you know, that's definitely preference, but it just like really threw me off. Maybe she was having a bad day and just it rolled over to something else, I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we talk about, whether it be the intimidation factor, the lack of knowledge. In the end, if you like wine, great. That's what it's all about, if you like the wine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I think the intimidation factor is a huge thing for wine. It does make it inaccessible for some people. And like to run with that example of me pouring wine in Safeway, you know, I've heard about times my dad's gone to pour wine in Safeway and he has a really hard time, but I don't have a hard time. I get in there and often I'll sell basically all the wine that they have stocked in that supermarket when I go. But I think a large part of that is because I'm a lot younger. I'm a lot less intimidating for consumers to come up and pour from, you know. If they see my dad, you know, 50-something-year-old dude with an accent, like, great winemaker, but, you know, that's a lot of intimidation to, you know, taste wines in front of.
It's true. I think that younger people will make it more accessible for people because you maybe have a different approach. And I think for my two cents is that somebody who's been in the business for a long time has so much knowledge. I guess it would be the same thing, not a great comparison, but talking to a mechanic when you have a problem with the car, we all feel like idiots.
Yeah, big time. Yeah. Someone was saying just yesterday, like how when you go to the mechanic and they make you feel like an idiot, like you go there and they, you know, you already feel a little bit intimidated when you get there, and then you feel even worse as you speak with them. And I hope that does, you know, it does happen in wine. It definitely happens. I definitely try to watch myself, you know, when I'm speaking about wine. It's on the flip side, it's very hard to talk about wine very, you know, detailed and not sound like a snob. It's really hard for me to geek out about wine and not sound like it, like an a-hole.
Yeah. The thing is, you're trying to educate somebody. I get that. It's not an easy thing to communicate, especially, you know, we've talked before about the vino lingo thing, about letting people know what these words mean.
Oh, totally.
you use a word and somebody looks at you kind of cross-eyed like, what are you talking about? You know, and
yeah
it's
trying to find a way for people to relate to it is always the best way that I go about it. I've definitely been asked by, you know, a friend, and he's just like, hey, how do you even taste these wines? You know, how do you taste so many next to each other and pick out the differences and kind of saturate your palate like that? And this guy, I mean, he drinks a lot of whiskey. He drinks a lot of Jameson in particular. And I, you know, to relate to him, I was like, honestly, man, if I put four whiskeys in front of you and one of them is Jameson, you're probably going to be able to pick out which one it is. And he was like, oh, you know, you're probably right. I could do that. And that's a good relation.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. It's like anything that's sense related.
Yeah. We do a lot of repetition. We do a lot of practice, taste a lot of wines.
Oh, my God. It's amazing. Just seeing a blending session. I think you'd said before that you've done blending sessions with your dad. I can't begin to imagine.
Yeah, quite a few, and it is quite tough. You get used to it, though. I actually, the first time I had to taste a bunch of wines, there's a wine competition called the North Coast Sonoma Wine Show, I think. Daryl Groom puts it on, but he organized it so that you could have people like me come in and sit at the table with the judges. So it was like an associate judge. So I would sit at the judging table and score with them, but my points didn't necessarily count to the publication.
Sure.
But it definitely gave you an exposure for how fast some of these people can taste and describe these wines. I definitely had to find my pace with these tasters at the time.
You know, I think I'm going to kind of go down a little alley here for myself.
Yeah.
I'm an audio engineer. It's what I do for a living. And people sometimes will make, oh, you have, you know, great hearing. It's like, no, I don't. I don't have great hearing.
Huh.
I listen differently. And I think that's a reasonable rule to apply to a winemaker and wine lovers, is that they're tasting differently. They're trained. You're trained to taste something different, right?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting way to say it. In what kind of way do you think you listen differently? Do you mind?
It's experience. I had an intern years ago who's a great guy, and I'm really proud of him because he's still in the business. But he once said to me, his friends were saying to him, it's like, wow, these recordings are really good. Why are they? And he goes, well, I have better hearing than you. And I laughed. I said to him, you don't have better hearing than anybody. I mean, yeah, sure. Some people, just like people, maybe have more taste receptors.
Yeah.
We all listen differently. I'll be in a room and I'll hear something, when I used to do field sound for film, I'd pick out things saying, okay, this is going to be a problem. People look at you funny like, what are you talking about?
Wow.
You know, I
can definitely understand that. That is very much in the way that, like, tasting is, like, you know.
Yeah.
Because we're trained to do it. We're trained to do it.
Exactly. And it's a really interesting point to talk about with people, because if you could find what their thing is, you can relate better to it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's something that, I mean, I think that's a little bit of what art is. You know, people can be creative with their, you know, with their abilities and with their expertise.
Sure.
You know, how the environment is affecting me and how I view wines based on my environment.
Exactly. Luke, this has been a lot of fun to talk to you. You know, this is really cool because I expect to be doing this podcast for a long time, and it'd be fun to catch up with you in another 5 years and see where you're at, because of, you know, you're younger, you're building into this career, and you clearly do have that passion.
Yeah.
It would be cool to think about that.
Wow.
It'd be fun, you know?
Thank you. That would actually be really cool if it works out like that. I hope so.
I hope so for you. People who are in this business, it's the passion of it. I'm going to bring up one last point, which somebody, a winemaker from Finger Lakes, said this to me, and I've been bringing it up a lot. You don't often meet an ex-winemaker or a former winemaker, do you?
No, I can't think of any in particular. No. It's too good of a gig.
Exactly.
Well, it's got ups and downs, definitely.
Right, exactly. So for our listeners who like to learn about you, for the time being, especially the fact you're looking for a gig, but for people who'd like to talk to you, if you're willing to talk to them, how would people get a hold of you, let's say by email or any of the social media?
Just my email is pretty simple. It's just Luke Goldschmidt, LukeGoldschmidt, @gmail.com. And yeah, like I said, I am looking for any kind of work. But if you also want to follow me on Instagram, It's the same Luke Goldschmidt underscore wine is my public page, and I'll put a little bit of bottle shots up there or travel photos, things like that.
Excellent. Cool. Luke, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. I hope you survive the cold of Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, the cold. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it. It was a good time.
You can contact Luke at lukegoldschmidt@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.